15-year-old girl, alone, confused, sad, addicted, and trafficked on the streets of New York City. She hears sirens in the background, and she knows what that means. It means run. So she and all the other young women out on the track run, but they're not fast enough. The police come, and they chain them all together and take them down to the police station. And she's kind of worried because she's addicted to heroin, and she knows she can't spend that many minutes in the police station, but she goes to the police station, and she goes to court, and they sentence her to Rikers Island Prison. And she's thinking, I have to get out of here. I've heard horror stories, and I don't want to be in Rikers Island Prison. So she breaks the programming that the trafficker has drilled into her head, and she says, I'm Barbara Amaya. I'm not 21. I'm 15 years old, and I'm from Fairfax, Virginia. Please help me. Please find my family. I just want to go back home. And they do. They say, we found your family. They're coming to pick you up. She feels a sense of relief. They're coming to pick me up. At the same time, I felt so many other emotions. I was scared. I didn't know what I was going to say. I'd been gone for 3 years. They take me to the room where my parents are going to be waiting. I open the door and I step inside. And it's my trafficker in the room, not my parents. And to this day, I don't know how that happened. Not sure. The summer I turned 12, I ran away from my Fairfax, Virginia home. And I want to repeat that. The summer I turned 12, I ran away from home and I went to nearby Washington, D.C. I'd been being abused and nobody would listen to me, so I ran away from home. In DuPont Circle, a young woman approached me and she said she wanted to help me and she understood how I felt. And I went back with her to her apartment and sadly, her trafficker was there. She had been out like recruiting other runaways. Maybe she'd been one herself one day. One day they took me to the corner of 14th and I Streets, not that far from here, in our nation's capital, and they sold me to a trafficker from New York. And I can remember that day like it was yesterday. My memory's pretty messed up from some of the stuff I've been through, but I can remember that day. I remember the money exchanging hands, and I remember him driving me up to New York, and I remember him taking things up a notch, you know, really. He programmed me, and I use that word on purpose, he programmed my young mind. He knew exactly how to create a commodity out of a human being. He knew how to create a trauma bond. I always get asked, why didn't you just leave? How could that be possible? I bonded with the trafficker. He knew how to create that bond. I never had my first dance. I never had my first innocent kiss. I never went to high school because I was 12 years old when I left home. But I did have an 85-year-old man die on top of me when I was 16 years old, being trafficked in New York.
Welcome to Human Monsters. Most people would like to think that slavery is an antiquated phenomenon, something that was most common in ancient cultures. The reality is that slavery didn't end with the Emancipation Proclamation. For one thing, that only put an end to slavery in the United States. It continued on in other parts of the world. Slavery is not a thing of the past, either. It lives on to this day, only the terminology has changed. Slavery is now most commonly known as human trafficking. The most commonly used definition of slavery today is quoted from the Palermo Protocols. The purpose of the Palermo Protocols is to prevent, suppress, and punish all individuals and organizations that traffic in human beings for the purposes of forcing them into unpaid menial labor, forced street begging, and sex work. The Palermo Protocols were adopted by the UN General Assembly in 2000 and were accepted by over 150 countries. The Palermo Protocols define human trafficking as the recruitment, transportation, transfer, harboring, or receipt of persons by means of the threat or use of force or other forms of coercion, of abduction, of fraud, of deception, of the abuse of power or of a position of vulnerability, or of the giving or receiving of payments or benefits to achieve the consent of a person having control over another person for the purpose of exploitation. To quote Pope Francis, "The trade in human beings, a modern form of slavery, violates the God-given dignity of so many of our brothers and sisters and constitutes a true crime against humanity." In 2014, the leaders of the world's largest religions signed a shared commitment to eliminate human trafficking by 2020. Aside from Pope Francis, leaders representing the Buddhist, Anglican, Orthodox Christian, Hindu, Jewish, and Islamic faiths signed the document. The goal of a trafficker when embarking on a relationship with a victim is to dehumanize them until they become a slave. The tactics they employ can lead to the psychological effect known as learned helplessness. The result is that the victim feels they no longer have any autonomy or control over their life. The trafficker may hold the victim captive, force them to imbibe large amounts of drugs or alcohol, keep them isolated, and even withhold food and sleep. The extreme, prolonged stress, combined with feelings of depression, guilt, shame, self-blame, rage, resentment, sleep disturbances, post-traumatic stress disorder, and numbing weakens the victim to the point where they cannot summon the strength to resist. Their spirit is broken, and it is at that point when learned helplessness seeps in. To break down a victim for the purpose of forcing them into sex trafficking, violent tactics are usually employed. The victim will be hunted down and repeatedly tortured, raped, verbally abused, socially isolated, brainwashed, and beaten. Once they have been enfeebled, they resign themselves to their fate as a sex worker to avoid more torment. Further trauma is piled on due to living in captivity and knowing that only their captors benefit from the financial recompense. By having been isolated from their family, friends, and in some cases, their nation of birth, they can become dependent on the perpetrator to survive, making it even harder to escape. This is compounded due to language barriers and a lack of familiarity with the culture to which they have been transplanted. Their personal documentation may even be withheld, making it impossible for them to be processed through the machinations of emigration. It goes without saying that being exploited as a victim of human trafficking is detrimental to one's mental and physical well-being. Along with the rape, sometimes by individuals and sometimes by groups, the trauma can be damaging and long-lasting. Depending on their level of immersion, the victims are often forced into living conditions that are squalid and emotionally taxing. They may receive little to no health care and may be neglected of other services that are vital to their well-being. Restrictions are placed on their movement. To keep them productive and behaving according to the trafficker's expectations, the parties who enslave them subject them to considerable physical, emotional, sexual, and psychological violence. Escaping from slavery is very difficult and dangerous. They can even be subjected to worse treatment if they are caught. They could even be killed. Traffickers may initially take the form of neighbors, friends, returnees, agricultural operators, small business owners, diplomats, other government officials, and family members. More recently, traffickers operate as part of an organized crime syndicate, often in collaboration with corrupt law enforcement officials, government officials, and employers. They may pass through several intermediaries to get from one agent through to another. If a victim of human trafficking is rescued, reintegrating back into society can be very difficult. During their time of enslavement, they were likely targeted for shame, stigma, trauma, and retribution. After experiencing ego death and the loss of their self-esteem, regaining their sense of self may take a long time. It's understandable when you consider that all power over their lives was possessed and controlled by human monsters. Some facts. Globally, the median cost of a slave is $90. According to some estimates, approximately 80% of human trafficking involves sexual exploitation. 19% involves forced labor. There are approximately 20 to 30 million slaves in the world presently. The poorest countries with the most restrictions on freedom of speech are most likely to become epicenters of sex trafficking. A transitional economy rampant with gender inequalities in the country's labor market is also correlated with high rates of trafficking. According to the U.S. State Department, 600,000 to 800,000 people are trafficked across international borders every year. 80% are female, 50% are children. The average age of a teen who enters the sex trade in the U.S. is 12 to 14 years. Many victims are girls who have run away from home after enduring years of sexual abuse. Three of America's premier hubs for child sex trafficking are located in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and San Diego. Atlanta, Georgia is known as the largest hotspot for trafficking in the U.S. due to its size and the access to its large airport. According to a 2014 study conducted by the Urban Institute, traffickers in Atlanta grossed as much as $32,000 in a single week. The National Human Trafficking Hotline receives most of its calls from Texas. 15% of those calls are made from the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Between 14,500 and 17,500 people are trafficked into the U.S. every year. Human trafficking is the third largest criminal industry in the world, after the trafficking of arms and narcotics. Human trafficking generates an estimated $32 billion in profits every year. Of that figure, $15.5 billion is made in the first world. According to the International Labor Organization, women and girls are estimated to represent the largest segment of forced labor victims, with an estimated 11.4 million females, or 55%, subjugated at any time. Males comprise 9.5 million victims, or 45%, and are mostly forced into menial work. Some human trafficking laborers are forced into bonded labor, also known as debt bondage. This arrangement is made when the worker's labors are demanded to pay off a loan. More often than not, the worker is coerced into working long after the loan has been repaid. The debt may even be passed on to the next generation. Forced labor is defined as any work that people are forced to do against their will. 16 million, or 64% of people working in forced labor, are employed by the private economy, exploited by individuals or enterprises. According to the United Nations International Labor Organization, or ILO, there are 24,900,000 people trapped in forced labor. According to a report by the U.S. State Department, Belarus, Iran, Russia, and Turkmenistan are represented among the worst offending nations when it comes to enabling human trafficking. Many children are indentured into slavery. It is estimated that of the worldwide total of slaves, 1 in 4 are children. Children are frequently exploited in many forms of menial labor, including domestic slavery. Live-in migrant domestic workers, such as au pair girls, are especially vulnerable to exploitation because since they are confined to a private home, they are isolated from the kind of protections that are available in a conventional workplace. An estimated 30 million children in India are employed in hard, unpaid labor to pay off their parents' debts. Child marriage often takes the form of slavery. It qualifies as exploitation if it meets the following three criteria. if either party has not given their free and informed consent, if either party is being subjected to control and a sense of ownership, and if either party cannot realistically leave or end the marriage. Servile marriage can also affect adults. To quote Dr. Lucy Steinitz, Catholic Relief Services Senior Technical Advisor for Protection, they are hidden from view. You don't recognize them in the back kitchens, shops, gas stations, and in hospitality. They are also tucked away in fields. They don't come out and ask for help. It's a different kind of slavery than long ago. They are not in shackles or on plantations. People are coerced into harsh employment under horrible conditions and then have no freedom to leave. They are beaten, violated, and told they are worthless, that no one else wants them anymore. The causes of human trafficking are complex and interlinked. Causes often include economic, social, and political factors. Though poverty alone does not necessarily leave one vulnerable to trafficking, when combined with other factors, it can leave someone at higher risk to becoming indentured to exploitive individuals and agencies. Other factors include corruption, civil unrest, a weak government, lack of access to education or employment, family disruption and/or dysfunction, lack of human rights, or disruptions to the economy. Due to political and economic instability, millions of people have been displaced from their countries of origin and become vulnerable to exploitation by traffickers. Those who exploit them capitalize on their desperate need for the basic necessities of life. Maria Grazia Giammarinero, a United Nations human rights expert and the UN's special rapporteur on human trafficking, was quoted in a speech to the UN General Assembly as saying, "This means anti-trafficking measures must be integrated into all humanitarian action and all policies regarding people fleeing conflict." In 2013, the United Nations designated July 30th as the World Day Against Trafficking in Persons. This is commemorated annually. Methods of recruitment can also involve fake employment agencies, word of mouth through acquaintances and returnees, newspaper ads, front businesses, and abduction. The American government is at the forefront of efforts to address and crack down on human trafficking. The American policy emphasizes the so-called three P's: prevent trafficking, protect victims, and prosecute traffickers. The incidence of criminal prosecution for traffickers has increased, but not enough. Reasons include the absence of anti-trafficking legislation in some nations. In some countries, the legislation exists, but law enforcement officials and prosecutors do not know how to implement it. In some cases, victims do not cooperate with the justice system because they have been threatened by their exploiter. Sex trafficking is defined as when someone uses coercion or fraud to facilitate a sex act between the person they are exploiting and a client. It may also involve forcing a minor to engage in a sex act. A commercial sex act, as defined within the rubric of sex trafficking, involves prostitution, the production of pornography, and sexual performance in exchange for any item of value, such as money, drugs, shelter, food, or clothes. This industry is thriving because there is a strong demand for the services rendered. In other words, the client fuels the market with their money, therefore the trafficker or pimp exploits the victims to earn the money that is spent by the clients. Both adults and children are forced into sex work. Children who have been used to produce child pornography usually have a history of sex trafficking before the content is produced. The victims are boys and girls and are bought and sold for profit. The common age when a child enters sex trafficking is 14 to 16, a time when they are too naive to realize what is really happening. According to a 2010 report, Brazil and Thailand have the worst records of child sex trafficking. The traffickers find victims through a social network, the victim's neighborhood, clubs or bars, the internet, or their schools. The victims are promised such things as protection, love, adventure, home, and opportunity. The victims live in fear of social stigma or misinformation, and as a result, they may never be identified due to their fear of retribution by the trafficker. The trafficker may also threaten to have them arrested. If their situation is misidentified by therapists, the victim may only be treated for superficial symptoms rather than the root cause. Without getting to the bottom of what has caused their suffering, trafficking victims are often only treated for such things as drug abuse, alcoholism, domestic violence, delinquency, teenage pregnancy, sexually transmitted diseases, and the complications of botched abortions. To ensure they will receive compliance from the victims and keep up with demand, traffickers use fear, violence, intimidation, and threats, as with all trafficking victims. Sex traffickers frequently target children residing in foster care and group homes. These children are more vulnerable to exploitation because of the trauma they have endured and the lack of a stable home life. Traffickers may also capitalize on a child's desire for attention and love, only to manipulate them into being exploited. Victims who are not found in foster care or group homes are often found on the streets. American children who are trafficked within the U.S. often start out as runaways. They are easily exploited because of their emotional vulnerability, inexperience in the real world, homelessness, and the need to survive. Sometimes left with no other option to provide for themselves, youths may resort to engaging in, quote, survival sex for money. This may in turn leave them vulnerable to pimps and other traffickers involved in prostitution networks. 74% of child trafficking cases involve sex work. The majority of those enterprises are controlled by pimps. An estimated 55% of homeless girls and a large percentage of boys engage in prostitution, and some experts feel the incidence may be higher. Children with a history of being supported by the welfare system are especially vulnerable to trafficking. In the U.S., 60% of domestic child trafficking victims have a history of receiving care from social workers. As far as exploitation of minors in the U.S. goes, children of all races, nationalities, socioeconomic backgrounds, and religions are smuggled in and out of America. They may be brought to America legally, but many are smuggled in. Children residing in other countries may be lured to America through the promise of opportunities for education, work, and the vow that they will be able to send money back home to their families. Such children are vulnerable to being exploited by kidnappers, pimps, and professional brokers due to their desperation to elevate themselves out of extreme poverty. Many children are sold to traffickers by their families, who may or may not fully grasp what will eventually happen to their child. American-born children are also trafficked within the U.S. and can be trafficked in both urban and rural areas. This is not true of all of the families of child sex trafficking victims. Some parents, out of desperation due to extreme poverty, have resorted to selling their children into prostitution to make ends meet. The highest incidence of forced child labor occurs in sub-Saharan Africa, though the largest population of child workers are found in Asia and the Pacific. For children from other countries, part of the attraction consists of uniting or reuniting with relatives who live in the destination. They may have been misled by returning migrant workers, both legal and illegal, who claim to have made a better living for themselves. The UNODC, or United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, reported that in 2012, the percentage of child victims had increased over 3 years from 20% to 27%. Of every 3 children indentured, 2 are girls. Gender and age statistics compiled globally revealed that 59% of the victims were women, 14% were men, 17% were girls, and 10% were boys. It is estimated that 76% of transactions for sex with underage girls begin on the internet. UNICEF's report on the sexual exploitation of children estimates that 2 million children are subjected to prostitution in the global commercial sex trade. Clients of sex trafficking victims are more complicit in their victimization. This has become facilitated in part by sex tourism and child pornography, two industries with international reach that are facilitated by the internet. These make wider options available to pedophiles. They enable instant and nearly undetectable transactions due to advances in technology that ensure near-complete privacy for those who seek these services. Pimps capitalize on the youngest of the children the most, especially those who are virgins or are perceived as such. In some cases, prepubescent girls are injected with hormones to activate early puberty. The average lifespan of a victim of human trafficking after they are indentured is 7 years. Common causes of death are fatal abuse, HIV and other STDs, malnutrition, drug overdose, or suicide. Those who survive the ordeal face significant consequences to their mental and physical health. These include sleeping disorders, eating disorders, sexually transmitted diseases, HIV or AIDS, since traffickers do not take precautions to ensure their victims are protected from the disease, pelvic pain, rectal damage, urinary dysfunction, and other physical complications that arise from years of being sexually assaulted, drug addiction, physical disabilities due to hard labor and perilous conditions of agriculture, sweatshop work, cleaning, food service, construction, leather tanning, mining, and stone quarry work. Health complications can include chronic pain, hearing loss, cardiovascular or respiratory problems. Mental health complications, such as helplessness, shame, humiliation, shock, denial, disbelief, disorientation, confusion, anxiety disorders, post-traumatic stress disorder, phobias, panic attacks, and depression. Victims could also experience traumatic bonding, also known as Stockholm syndrome. It is a form of coercive control in which the perpetrator manipulates the victim into feeling gratitude for being permitted to be in their employ, and to be grateful for whatever favors or leniencies may have been extended to them. Stockholm syndrome is particularly problematic for girls while they are trafficked, making it harder for them to escape. As a result, their progress in post-trafficking therapy can be slow. Guilt is another possible side effect, as is culture shock from living in a foreign land. Experiencing severe trauma on a daily basis, as child victims of human trafficking typically do, can hinder the healthy development of biological integrity and cognitive functioning. The effect of growing up in environments endemic to exploitation and criminal behavior can lead to antisocial behavior, over-sexualized behavior, self-harm, aggression, and distrust of adults. They can also experience dissociative disorders, complex trauma, and attention deficit disorders. Boys who are victimized by sexual exploitation are not as well served by social services and law enforcement agencies. This is due to the misconception that boys are better equipped than girls to fend for themselves. Research has indicated that without intervention and treatment, many boys transition from victimhood to becoming abusers of boys and girls as pimps and traffickers in their own right. Boys have been found to experience PTSD and additional stressors that accompany the social stigma of homosexuality, since abusers of boys are typically male. Unresolved anger and desire for revenge may preoccupy them for the years to come. Victims of sex trafficking are often literally branded by their traffickers or pimps. These are tattoos of barcodes, the trafficker's name, or rules. Those victims who manage to escape still possess these tattoos as painful reminders of their pasts and trigger complications of PTSD. Tattoo removal is highly expensive, making the procedure inaccessible for those who lack the financial means. Forced marriage. A marriage is deemed to have been forced if one or both participants were wedded without their freely given consent. Servile marriage involves a marriage whereupon a person is sold, transferred, or inherited into the marriage. A forced marriage qualifies as a form of human trafficking when certain criteria are taken into consideration. If the woman is sent abroad, forced into the marriage, and repeatedly coerced into having sex with the husband, the marriage can be deemed sex trafficking. If the wife is treated as a domestic servant by her new husband and/or his family, this qualifies as labor trafficking. Organ trafficking. Trafficking in human organs counts as human trafficking. It takes different forms. In many cases, the victim is coerced into giving up an organ. Sometimes the victim will be promised compensation, but will receive none. In other cases, the organ will be removed while the victim is being treated for another illness, real or fabricated. People most vulnerable to human trafficking for the purpose of harvesting and selling human organs are migrant workers, homeless people, and the illiterate. Organ trafficking is a form of organized crime. It involves several participants at different levels of the process. The recruiter, the transporter, the medical staff, the contractors, the buyers. Kidneys are especially popular in the organ trafficking syndicate. It is a very lucrative trade because in many nations there are long waiting lists for patients who need transplants. Solutions. Lawmakers and law enforcement agencies have invested a great deal of time and resources to cracking down on human trafficking. Unfortunately, the answer to stamping out this phenomenon is not always obvious. Different nations have differing criminal codes, and there are also cultural considerations to contend with. Corrupt and/or inadequately trained police officers are sometimes complicit in sex trafficking. In some cases, they even commit violence against sex workers, including those who have been trafficked. Some human traffickers capitalize on a corrupt legal system when blackmailing victims. If they have brought them to a foreign land, they may threaten to have them deported. They could also turn victims against one another, with the possible result of having some of them sent to jail for their crimes. There can be conflict in anti-trafficking agendas between groups. For example, in some districts, sex workers have established unions and other organizations which have sought to eliminate trafficking. Law enforcement has their own ways of detecting and prosecuting trafficking, and their methods may be seen as infringing on the sex workers' rights and agency. For example, in India, the DMSC, or Durbar Mahila Samanwaya Committee in Kolkata, has, quote, self-regulatory boards that patrol red light districts and assist girls who are underage and or trafficked. They feel that because many police are often corrupt and abusive, they should oppose police intervention and often do. They feel that when police bring underage girls out of brothels, it may have an adverse impact on the girls, since the police tend to take an aggressive approach. Critics of this argument contend that since sex trafficking is both an economic and violent crime, it requires that law enforcement intervene, thereby preventing future violence against the victims. There is also a theory that the continued criminalization of sex work maintains the demand for sexual services provided by the underground sex trade. The origins for sex tourism can be traced back to the Vietnam War. Sex between American servicemen and young Asian girls was facilitated. When the war ended, the prostitutes lost their income. To compensate for this loss, Asian governments took official measures to bolster their economies through sex tourism. To this day, child prostitution is a thriving industry in Asia. Patrons come from such areas as the United States, Germany, Sweden, Europe, Australia, and Japan. It remains popular because it is the one area on Earth where men can engage in sex with minors without being prosecuted, at least in the country where the encounters take place. There is a high demand, but limited supply, of female child prostitutes. Therefore, there is competition among the countries and procurers that maintain the industry. With the depletion of young victims in Asia, traffickers will travel to other countries and bring back girls for trafficking purposes. Girls from Thailand are particularly represented in these countries because they have been abducted and transported to such nations as Burma, China, India, and other countries in the region. These practices and their effects have spread worldwide. Asian countries with high populations of child prostitutes include Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam, China, the Philippines, and Taiwan. The trafficking of human beings for the purpose of enslaving them in unpaid labor and prostitution is one of the most egregious evils of this world. There are many organizations raising awareness and donations in their commitment to put an end to this phenomenon. The parties responsible for this exploitation are among the worst human monsters on the face of the earth. One person who knows this all too well is author Hope Doe. Her memoir, Suicide and Sex Work, Finding God in a Godless World, details her experiences as a victim of child sex trafficking. The book will be released July 30th, 2019. She joins us via Skype to discuss the events that she has documented and how she copes with the aftermath now. Let's go talk to Hope. Hi, Hope.
Yes.
Hey, this is Morgan. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you? Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Yeah. So, yeah, thank you for doing the podcast. And first of all, I'll just get you to tell me about your book. So what is the title and what is it? What ground does it cover? Basically describe what the plot of the book is.
Okay. I just wanted to say thank you for having me on your podcast. I'm really excited to be here and to get to talk with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
The name of my book is Suicide and Sex Work, Finding God in a Godless World. It releases on July 30th of 2019, which is actually the World Day Against Trafficking in Persons, which is why I chose that day.
Oh, yeah, great timing, yeah.
And the book itself is my testimony. So it's my story of going through sex trafficking and then after that becoming a sex worker and my healing through all of that and what that did to my faith.
And how will the book be available for sale?
You can order it at barnesandnoble.com or you can go into your local Barnes & Noble and order it. You can actually pre-order it now.
And so it's written under your pseudonym Hope Doe. That's how it's written?
Yes.
Okay, so what I'm going to start off with, so I'd like to know about your pre-trafficking life. Can I get a thumbnail of the circumstances of your life before it all started, like where you were born, what kind of circumstances did you live in with your family, etc.?
I grew up in I started out in a very, like, typical household. My parents lived together. They were married. I had a big brother. We grew up out in the middle of nowhere, USA. When I tell people where I'm from now, they still go, "Where is that?" So it was very normal from the outside. Beyond that, we were extremely poor. I grew up with, it was very common for us to not have food in the house and to not have electricity, to be behind on our rent. So it was very stark contrast what everyone else saw versus what was actually going on at home.
But were you living in a rural area or in a city or a small town or?
We were living in a rural area just outside of an incredibly small town. The population of the town itself where I went to school was about 100.
Oh, I see. Were your parents unable to find work?
They actually both had full-time jobs. In my younger years, my mom didn't work, but when I started school, my mom started a job. I grew up in an alcoholic home, so that's where most of our money went to.
Oh, okay. And so the stress of dealing with the poverty and everything else, how was your relationship with your parents?
It's a really complicated situation with my parents because I did go through trafficking as a child. So even now I still have a lot that I'm kind of wrestling with different information, and not being sure how to really take them and whether they knew about the situation, how that all played into it. Mm-hmm. So I'd say that we were never super close. I've always been kind of a daddy's girl, but that went to the wayside very quickly.
Yeah, different people have clear memories of their life from 6 years old going backwards, and then some people remember very little. So how clear are your memories of that time of your life?
I have some very distinct memories that I could probably tell you weird details about that that normally others wouldn't remember. And then there are chunks of time that are just blank.
Oh, I see. And now, who was responsible for coercing you into the sex trade? You don't have to give a name, of course, but who was it? What was their relationship to you?
He was my great uncle. And he was also my dad's boss and my neighbor and my babysitter. So,
were your parents aware of this?
Like I said, that's something that I'm really, still struggling with. I'm not entirely sure. I have suspicions, but I can't definitively say necessarily yes, they knew, or no, they didn't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have memories that lean to, like, obviously they knew about it. But that's something that's really hard for me to grapple with. So,
sure. And did that uncle take liberties with you? Did he sexually abuse you?
Yes, he actually, he started molesting me before any of the trafficking started. He sexually abused me for 2 years before the first time that I was trafficked.
And so how did he go about getting you involved in that whole area of child sex trafficking in terms of, I guess, making it routine and making it profitable? How did he go about it?
He just kind of started out with a client, is what I usually call them. Just one or two here and there, and it gradually just became more frequent. I found out later that he was making and selling meth. So he just kind of, in general, had just a criminal background. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really sure on his end how things got started and how he went about that and how he knew how to get clients. I don't have a way to know any of that.
And so did he really, like, force you aggressively into it, or were you manipulated? How did he get you to actually do these things?
At that point, when it first started, I thought I had to. Mm-hmm. He was a grown-up, and he was telling me, a child, that I had to do this. And I really didn't have the capacity to know, hey, this is wrong, I shouldn't be doing this, this is bad. I knew that it felt bad, and I knew I was confused, but I didn't know that I was allowed to tell him that I didn't want to do it.
And what kind of people were the clients? Were they real lowlifes, real underworld types, or were they come from other economic classes?
With as many clients as I had, they came from all walks of life, from members that were active in my church to local government, these like fine, upstanding citizens, to people with warrants out for their arrest, to just criminals in general.
And as far as the so-called upstanding citizens, have you ever recognized any of them in the media, for instance?
I have around like election time. I've since moved somewhat away from that area. So I don't see advertisements up for re-election as much. And also, this was over a decade ago. So a lot of them have kind of stepped down from their positions. They've retired. So I don't see them as much in the media. But I am in a local big town near that small city. So I do see them around occasionally.
And what is it like, I'm particularly curious about, you know, seeing all the election propaganda, talking about what great people they are, what they have to offer. And I'm thinking, what must that have been like for you to think of your experience with them while all that's going on?
When I was younger, I was terrified that these men were continuing to be given power, because I knew what they would be doing with that power. As I got older, it just kind of made me angry that these people don't deserve to be in office. They don't deserve to have a leadership position. They don't deserve that recognition and those accolades. Now I think I'm a little cynical about it. And it shouldn't be like this, but I kind of feel like it just happens. Mm-hmm. That they're given these positions, and they just think that they're invincible now.
And what was your life like between these encounters with clients? Did you go to school, or did you have a normal life at all?
I did go to school. I went to school regularly. I got good grades for the most part. I was involved in extracurriculars. I played sports. I was a Girl Scout. So there were things that I got to do that were just normal child things. And I made a point to include those in my book because it's important for me, for people to see the contrast. Like, I was living a normal, quote-unquote normal, life when I was going to school and I was hanging out with my friends versus when I went home.
And I can't help but wonder if at the same time there must have been a certain amount of loneliness that went along with that, in terms of thinking that you didn't know anyone who was going through it. You maybe didn't think you could talk to anybody about it. I don't know if you knew it was wrong instinctively. So did that persist as well, where like in the background there's this trauma going on?
Absolutely, especially with adults, because there were more than one circumstance where I told an adult that something bad was happening to me and nobody did anything. And I was met with a lot of pushback. So especially around adults, I grew up kind of thinking, I can't trust these people, because the adults in my life that I trust are hurting me, and the ones that I'm reaching out to for help are also by extension hurting me by not believing me, not helping me.
And was there any other kind of abuse besides the sexual abuse? Was that uncle physically abusive to you or emotionally abusive?
He was incredibly manipulative. Just with the, I love you, I want to take care of you, I want what's best for you kind of thing. And he just gradually got more cruel and more violent. As a means of continuing to take control of me. Mm-hmm. And, he eventually started doing the drugs that he was making, and in doing the drugs that he was making, those things, the cruelty and the violence, just got worse.
And did he ever bribe you, or did he ever share any of the proceeds, with you, any of the money at all?
No, I never got any of the money. He did, especially in the earlier years, I regularly got gifts. He bought me a nice ring, and it was just a promise ring. Those were his words, promise ring. He got me gifts on my birthday and at Christmas. He bought me Valentines. So especially in the earlier years, he spent money on me, but I never received any of the money he was making.
And did you ever tell any of your friends about what was going on, or ever ask them if they had these experiences, like wondering how normal is this exactly?
I don't remember ever asking anyone specifically if that was something that was happening to them, because it had been so ingrained in me that I was not allowed to tell anyone. I was not allowed to say anything. And the few times that I did say something and my uncle found out about it, I was severely punished. So I learned very quickly to keep my mouth shut. So I didn't really talk about it with my friends. But I do remember wondering if everyone's life was like mine.
And how were you able to cope with it at the time?
I think for the most part, I just kind of ignored it. I just kind of hoped that it would go away. And as I got involved in things at school, I kind of threw myself into that, into sports, which I was not good at all, mm-hmm. Into Girl Scouts that I loved. When I discovered reading, I threw myself into that. Anything where I could be focused on something else and not have to think about how alone I was and how confusing everything was.
So did you ever dissociate, where you tried to tune out of the experience and separate yourself from it to some extent?
Yes, there were times where I don't think I would have survived if I had had to stay in my body. There were times where I remember thinking I need to go away, and then I would. And obviously part of me is still there and part of me still enduring the trauma, but being able to take a step back from that and pretend that it's not me that it's happening to was the only way I got through some of that stuff.
Though it goes without saying that child sexual abuse is very cruel, were there any clients that were especially sadistic or who tortured you to some extent, where they seem to be getting off on the aspect of inflicting pain?
Yes. Like I said before, I had all kinds of clients. So I had clients that were horrible to me. And then I had clients who were gentle and kind, which kind of added to the confusion, because there were now no kind of men that I could trust.
Mm-hmm. And were you ever given drugs or alcohol by your uncle or anybody else?
Yes. That was actually something that happened semi-frequently. I'm not sure what they were giving me. I just know that they gave it to me in drink form. It was some kind of drug mixed in with orange juice. And it would just make me pass out. And I learned when you're given this orange juice, you down it, like just chug the whole bottle. Mm-hmm. Because it would take effect quicker. And I would pass out quicker, the faster I got it into my system.
I guess that way you wouldn't at least remember what happened. So was that
right?
Was that some kind of relief at least? Or
yes, mm-hmm. I could deal with waking up and having the after effects left, the after effects of the abuse. Because I was used to being in pain. I was used to having to take care of myself. But just that break, almost, that doesn't feel like the right word, but that's the one I can come up with. So just that break from the cruelty and the confusion and all of the other things that I was feeling.
And by the way, how old are you now?
I'm 23.
Yeah. So I was thinking of a Bill Cosby. I mean, you were too young to have grown up watching him on TV as I did. But how did you feel hearing about that whole scandal, how he used these chemicals to knock women out and rape them, as some of your clients did?
I think that is a good testament of people in power thinking that they can get away with anything. Mm-hmm. Because they think that they have not only this position where they feel like they're ahead above everyone else, but they also have the money to kind of make that happen. So like you said, I wasn't old enough to have grown up watching him. But there was a part of me that believed it right away, because that's what I had experienced. That's what I had witnessed. So when you kind of grow up learning that behavior, it just seems like something that's normal. Like, people do that. Not that that makes it acceptable, mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's so plausible because you've seen it yourself.
And by the way, how has the whole Me Too movement been for you?
I'm very careful when reading stories, because I have to look after my own mental health. Mm-hmm. But I am so proud of these men and women that are speaking out and that are sharing their story, because I know how hard that is. And I know how that can take a lot out of you. And I know how you never really know how people are going to react to you when you share your story. So I applaud these people for taking that step and sharing what could have very well been the worst experience of their life.
And and then reading some of those stories, have you come across any familiarities with your own experience where some of it sounded like things you went through?
The extent of what I went through kind of brings up this point where most times when I read someone's story, there's something I can relate to in it. Mm-hmm. Not that necessarily I went through exactly that, but I went through so much with so many different kinds of abusers that there's something that's familiar to me in almost every story that I read.
And have you gone online to find other people who've had your kind of experience? And if so, has that been therapeutic for you?
I have, and it has been therapeutic. It's helpful to be able to connect to people that know what you're feeling and know what you're experiencing without you having to really explain it. Mm-hmm. Because I found something that can be hard for me sometimes is talking to the people in my life who love me and who want to help, but have no idea how to wrap their brain around what I went through, which is very normal. And I'm glad that they don't have that frame of reference. Mm-hmm. But it's healing for me to be able to connect to other survivors and watch them overcome and watch them thrive, because it gives me hope for myself and for people that I hope to reach with my book and with my blog and with my social media.
And say someone has just met you and you're getting to know them, and then you reveal this experience. What would you say should be the do's and don'ts of what they should say? They want to understand it, and they really feel bad for you, but I think probably there are probably right and wrong things to say. What would you say are the wrong things to say?
As far as the wrong things to say, I've been lucky that I haven't had too many bad experiences in sharing my story. I think any kind of disbelief is really hard for me to hear, because I experienced that as a child when I was reaching out for help, people not believing me. I think trying to fix me is something that's hard for me to handle. It's one thing if I'm going to them for advice, then by all means, tell me what you think, tell me what to do. But I think the best reactions that I've gotten were, I've had people tell me that they don't understand, and there's no way that they could ever understand, but that telling them my story didn't change how they saw me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And hearing people tell me that they still love me and that they want to help. I've been met with, "Can I give you a hug?" Which is always a good thing to ask.
Yeah.
When someone discloses that to you. I've yet to have someone ask me if they can hug me and me tell them no.
Yeah.
Because when I get to the point where I'm face to face telling someone my story, I'm comfortable enough with them to have that interaction. But it's very validating just to have them ask.
Well, I hope nobody has ever said to you something like, "The past is the past. It has nothing to do with the present. Just forget about it." I hope no one's taken that approach.
I actually have heard more than once that it's in the past and it's not happening anymore and I need to move past it. And I think that's a very fine line to walk.
Yeah.
Because I have to be careful not to dwell in it because I get stuck. But I also have to remember that it's part of my story. It's part of who I've become. It's part of my faith.
Yeah.
And I think the balance is knowing now that it could be an equal part of my life. It doesn't have to be all consuming.
And just going back to the timeline of the events of the trafficking itself, did you try to escape the situation? You mentioned you did tell a few adults. Did you try anything else? Did you ever try running away? Or was there anything that you tried to do to get out of it?
I think telling was the only thing that I tried. I couldn't really run away. I knew that I wouldn't make it very far because I know the land that we lived in, like a vast acreage, my uncle owned.
Yeah.
So if I take off into the woods, he knows those woods much more than I do as a child. And some of my clients were hunters who have spent hours and hours in those woods. And I don't know if I was thinking that logically as a child. There was a level of helplessness. Like, he's too big, he's too powerful, he knows too many people, there's no way for me to get out of this.
Not to narrow it down too much, but do you live in the Midwest? Is that about where it is? Or
roughly, yes.
And what led to the cessation of all this? How were you rescued, or how did you leave the situation, or what put a stop to it?
My uncle actually got deported. He had dual citizenship between the U.S. and another country, and he was arrested for making meth. He got busted for that and was deported. So when that happened, since he was kind of spearheading the whole operation, it kind of just fell apart.
And how old were you when he finally was extradited?
I was 11.
11. And undoubtedly, and we touched on this earlier, but the trauma you experienced has, it's likely led you experiencing effects typical of post-traumatic stress disorder, which is a common thing. And there are a lot of complications that come along with that. So how does your experience affect you on a day-to-day basis?
It affects me a lot less now than it did even a year ago. But I actually have a diagnosis of complex PTSD, which is essentially caused by trauma over an extended period of time. So I still struggle with severe depression. I have a lot of triggers that remind me of trauma that I really struggle to get through. I have nightmares and flashbacks, typical PTSD symptoms. And there are days that are good and there are days that are bad.
One thing that's common among people who have been victims of this kind of experience is substance abuse. Did you ever turn to drugs or alcohol or anything else to cope with the complications?
I did, actually. I was put on prescription benzodiazepines for my anxiety, and I became addicted. I used on and off for, 3-4 years before going to treatment. And I went to a rehab facility for mental health. That was my primary reason for going. I went after a suicide attempt. But in going there, because it was a dual diagnosis facility, in going there, I got so much group therapy and community with other survivors and addicts and people who had just been through the ringer in life. And I got clean. I've been clean for 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days today.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. And so was that hard? I know addiction is never easy to end. You know, that it's like, you know, once an addict, always an addict. And so was that really tough, or did they have some kind of methadone like medication for you to take, or?
I actually didn't go on medication to stay off drugs. I'm one of the lucky ones that I was able to get help pretty quick. Like I said before, I ended up in treatment after a suicide attempt. So I had been in the hospital receiving fluids for several days that had kind of flushed a lot of that out of my system. Mm-hmm. So I was very lucky in how it all played out. Not everyone gets that.
And you mentioned earlier that your relationship with your parents is complicated. So when they found out about what your uncle had been doing to you, how did they react?
They actually, we have never had the conversation that I was trafficked.
Oh, I see.
They know that he molested me. They don't know anything beyond that.
And how did they, well, how did they react at least to the news that he had been molesting you?
I remember when I first told, I told a teacher when I was a seventh grader, so social services got involved and there was a police report filed, and the social worker went to talk to my mom, and when the social worker was there, she was crying and she was upset, and, all the normal, for lack of a better word, reactions of a parent who had just found out that their child had been abused. Mm-hmm. But once the social worker was gone, my mom was angry because I made her look bad.
So she made it all about her then?
Yes.
Oh. So do you have much contact with your parents now, or have all these feelings really kind of driven a wedge between, you know, your mother and you and your father and you?
There is definitely a wedge, but I still see them. I actually saw them today. They were here a few hours ago. They just kind of showed up. They do that sometimes. So I do see them. It's really hard. I don't like to spend extended periods of time with them, but they are still a part of my life, yes.
And are you nervous about publishing this book? I don't know if you're going to show them the book or if they're going to find out about it, but are you worried about that aspect of publishing?
I definitely am worried, yes. That's part of why I'm using a pseudonym, not only for safety reasons with my traffickers, but also because of my family. Because it's very shaky ground to share my story, because I don't know how it will be taken. I don't know what kind of reaction I will get from my family, because my trafficker was family. The only family I have any real connection with is that side of the family.
And
So I'm not sure. I'm not sure how they'll take it. I'm not sure if I'll be met with anger or aggression. I don't. There's not really a way for me to predict how it's going to play out, which is part of the reason I chose to publish under a pseudonym.
Well, I know in a lot of rural cultures, they can be sometimes misogynistic. The males are much more respected than the females, and the boys are often the favorites, and girls are not treated as well. Do you think that may have been a factor in it as well?
I don't really know if that's necessarily a factor, because in my small town, even the girls were kind of rough and tumble. Mm-hmm. I grew up, like I said, playing sports, which I wasn't very good at. I grew up playing outside and playing in the dirt and building tree houses and things that were very considered to be masculine activities, which mm-hmm. is kind of silly because I was just a child playing outside. But especially in my family, because my brother is not the things that would be typically considered masculine. So I was the tomboy and he was not.
Oh, interesting. And you mentioned the traffickers. So it sounds like they're part of a network. And I've read about these child sex rings before. You mentioned that you're publishing under the pseudonym because you're concerned about what their reactions would be. So I was wondering what you think is the potential they have for violence in terms of being exposed.
I am not entirely sure what they would do. I haven't like received any direct threats or anything. But I grew up with them abusing me. When you're placed into that situation, you learn a lot about these men. So I know what they're capable of.
Yeah.
Which is why it kind of scares me, because I know the level of violence that they're capable of. I know how cruel and sadistic they can be.
And after your uncle was deported, did any of them approach you somehow? Did they ever track you down and see if they could do it again?
I don't recall any of them reaching out to me specifically to kind of take over that role that my uncle had. I do remember that there were one or two, maybe three, that became clients when I was a teenager doing sex work. So I again was dealing with these same men.
So with all this trauma in your background, are you able to pursue a normal, healthy sexual relationship with someone wherein you're able to separate the sex you have consensually with the type you were forced into as a child? Is that become a very difficult thing for you, or are you able to separate the two?
It's kind of hit or miss. It depends on the situation. It depends on the person. I will occasionally have flashbacks. I do occasionally struggle with that kind of thing to the point where I avoid it. I've had trouble with going the other way and being promiscuous. So it does affect me sexually, yes, but it was such a big part of the formative years of my life that there's not really anything it doesn't affect.
I have heard about that promiscuity before, on the part of young women who have been sexually abused. I was wondering what's behind that. Is it a way of trying to reclaiming power over your body? Is that what it's about, or is there something else at play?
I can't speak for anyone but myself, but for me, I knew that it was just returning to what was normal. That was something that I knew how to do. It was something I knew I was good at. So that was just something that I went back to because that's what I had always gone to.
And when you started dating in earnest, I don't know what point it was when you started, you know, telling the people you're dating that this happened to you. What kind of reactions do you get? Are they ever turned off? Do they stop seeing you? Or are they understanding? What kind of reactions have you gotten?
I've actually only ever told two of my boyfriends. Mm-hmm. And the first one was really cool about it. He was a lot more mindful of triggers and making sure I was okay. And the other one I told was just like, wow, that's messed up, and just went about his business.
Oh, that must have hurt.
Because of his profession, I wasn't surprised. I just kind of assumed that he had heard or seen a lot of that.
So your faith has been important in your healing. What is your faith?
I'm a Christian. That is my faith.
Oh, okay. And so in what ways did it help? Did it have to do with the support of people, of knowing people there who would listen? What other aspects of it did it help you with?
I think part of it was I grew up in and out of the church. That was another thing that I did as a child. And I had seen people around me that just seemed so on fire and so in love with God, and they were getting all of this comfort and all of this grace, and I just remembered wanting that so much, to the point where it was something that I have been pursuing my entire life, and I'm still pursuing it to an extent, but especially in the church group that I have now, they just kind of accept me how I am. Mm-hmm. And having them accept me where I'm at and loving me through my struggles and celebrating my triumphs with me has been so healing. And I know I've seen in these people watching me struggle, they reach out to God. And they're like, God, I don't know what to do. Tell me what to do. And I have watched God guide their hands. And I've had similar experiences where I'm just like, I don't know what to do, God. I don't know what decision to make. I don't know where to turn. I don't know what to say. Help. Mm-hmm. And it's just been something that's been so much of a comfort to me. To have that. And when you have so much trauma in your life, there aren't many things that bring you comfort.
Yeah, that's right. Have you tried anything else to try to turn around your thinking, whether medication or anything in terms of just trying to break the cycle of having flashbacks, or do you think there's any way to stop that at all?
I mean, I've been in therapy for over a decade at this point, and I've been on, I think the last time I counted, 30 different psychiatric medications. So I've tried lots of different things. I have a therapist now who is very good, and she's very helpful. And I have a medication regimen that I do that is helpful, And adding to that, I I try to socialize. I try to be around people that I know love and support me. That's another thing that is very involved in my faith, because I have, not only do I have the faith to turn to where when I'm feeling overwhelmed, I can pray about it. I can listen to Christian music. I can read my Bible. I can prayer journal, or I can call someone. And I have this network of people in my life where I can call them and have them support me and have them kind of talk me down and help me ground myself. I've had instances in one of my church groups where I have flashbacks, and I've had them surround me and pray for me. I've had them ask my best friend Claire what's helpful, and she tells them what to do and what not to do. So there are so many different things that I've kind of discovered fairly recently that help with the flashbacks and that can help calm me down.
Well, that's good. And it's great to have that kind of network of support as well.
Yes, very much so.
I don't know if you're planning on having children someday, but if you do, do you think you would tell them about what happened to you?
I think that I would, but that would definitely be a conversation to have with adult children.
Oh, of course, yeah.
I kind of feel like that is a cross that bridge when you get to it.
Sure, yeah.
Kind of situation, because even now in my life, I have people that I love and that I trust and that are big parts of my life that I probably won't ever tell about my trafficking. I have a brother.
Have you told him what happened?
I have not.
Oh, I see. So do you think that he might end up kind of taking the same side of as your parents? Do you think he wouldn't understand?
I think that he falls more into the category of people that I wouldn't tell, even though I love them and I trust them, because of their personality. Because he's one of those hard on his sleeve kind of people. And I really just don't know with his personality and his life experience if he could handle that information.
Yeah, it is a pretty heavy thing to unload on someone, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, have you told your grandparents? Or are they still around? Or
I only have one grandparent, and she is, her sister was married to my uncle. So that there's a pretty close connection there. So that's another person that I don't know how she would handle it. So I'm afraid to tell her.
Sure. And you, by using the pseudonym, that could probably limit your ability to participate in activism on the behalf of people who've had these experiences. Will writing the book be the extent of that and your activities online? Or do you think you'd like to have more contact, perhaps directly, with people who've had those experiences?
I would love to have more contact with people who have been through that. Because I know for me, it's so helpful to have a conversation with someone who has been through it and who's gotten to a point where they function in their day-to-day life and they're doing the things that I want to do. It's really encouraging to me to have those people to look up to, and I would love to be able to be that person for someone.
Well, I thank you very much for joining me today, and I'm sure wherever your uncle ended up, it's a hell on earth, and he totally deserves to be there. Thank you so much for doing the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me tonight.
Yes, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, take care.
You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to Human Monsters. Please like our Facebook page. Goodbye.